afternoons beginning at 2 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 54 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello, this is Michael with a programming reminder. The coronavirus update will now air this afternoon following the local newspapers at 4:30 p.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
I would like to thank you for listening to Enable this week. Every now and then, I need to clean up some of the small clippings and the little articles that are hanging around. I call them timely tidbits, and that's what I have for you today. These timely topics will include celebrities, tech-tired eyes, lazy eyes, and winter safety tips. The first clipping comes from Parade Magazine, and quite a few of these timely tidbits did come from Parade Magazine last fall. I clipped them all, and I'll share them now. The first one is from August of last year. It says, "Seeing stars. Celebs like Bono, Judi Dench, and John Goodman deal with eye problems, too. Here's what you need to know." This little article was written by Cheryl Kraft, and it starts out by saying, "Everyone, no matter who they are, is susceptible to eye diseases," says Alexandra Rachaskaya, who's a doctor and a vitreoretinal specialist and assistant professor of ophthalmology at the Cleveland Clinic's Cole Eye Institute. "That's why it's so important to have regular eye exams and know your risk factors and family history." First topic they cover is glaucoma. When rocker Bono, age 60, wears sunglasses indoors, it's not just because he's cool. The tinted lenses protect his eyes from light sensitivity, a common side effect of glaucoma, which he has had for more than 20 years. The condition, which affects more than 2.7 million Americans, can damage the eye's optic nerve and, in severe cases, can cause blindness. It's often caused by a buildup of pressure due to improper drainage of the eye's clear fluid. There may be no early warning signs, but once it's progressed, you may notice a loss of peripheral or your side vision. Lowering eye pressure with laser therapy, eye drops, pills, or surgery can improve drainage and reduce the likelihood of vision loss. The next subject is cataracts. Actor John Goodman, age 68, is part of the group of more than 24.4 million Americans over 40 who have cataracts. When the eye's natural lens changes from clear to cloudy, the world can appear blurry, hazy, or even less colorful. Protecting your eyes from sunlight is one of the most important ways to slow down the development of cataracts, as studies show that years of exposure can increase the risk. The next topic is AMD. Actress Judi Dench, age 85, has age-related macular degeneration, or AMD, but she has not let it slow her down. The leading cause of vision loss in people over 50, and that means nearly 11 million Americans have it. It occurs when the center of the retina, or the macula, wears down. The biggest risk factor for AMD, age, family history, and smoking. Over time, people with AMD may lose their sharp central vision in one or both of their eyes, making it difficult to see fine details. Judi Dench can no longer read scripts, for example, but they still maintain their peripheral vision. About 90% of those with AMD have the dry form, which advances more slowly than the wet type, which begins as dry and occurs when new blood cells grow and leak fluid into the layer behind the retina, causing damage and forming scar tissue. Treatments that can help slow its progression include various medications injected directly into the eye and also laser therapy. And once again, this is from Parade Magazine. That's that little insert that they put into your Sunday paper. The next article is from that publication also. This one was published in September of last year. It's a whole page. It's part of the Stay Healthy feature. The headline reads, TLC for Tech-Tired Eyes. And coincidentally, it shows a picture of a woman with a laptop computer on her lap, open. She's got big glasses on. She's looking down at the computer screen. Technology has expanded our world, but are our eyes paying the price? This was written by Cheryl Kraft also. It's hard to avoid technology with TVs, tablets, computers, and mobile phones playing such a big part of our everyday lives, especially during quarantine. American adults spend almost half of each day interacting with screens, with those 60 and older devoting an extra half hour each day compared to what they were doing 10 years ago. But are these blue light emitting devices wrecking our health? The truth is, exposure to blue light can affect our sleep patterns. That's because its short wavelength, the blue light, can delay the release of melatonin, a natural hormone that prepares the body for sleep and shift our internal clock, the circadian rhythm, to a later schedule, pushing bedtime later than optimal. The healthy fix is to turn off electronics about an hour before bed. But when it comes to our eyes, that's another story. Many people think there's a direct correlation between blue light and eye damage. This is a quote from Rishi Singh, a doctor and a retinal specialist and staff surgeon at the Cole Eye Clinic Institute, the Cleveland Clinic. Yet the actual amount of blue light emitted from electronic devices is quite small and has not been shown to be harmful to our eyes, according to the American Academy of Ophthalmology. Here's a quote from Dr. Singh. It's not a blue light phenomenon, but instead a screen phenomenon, Dr. Singh says. It's how we use our screens and how much time we spend using them. This is what could be problematic. Good screen hygiene can go a long way toward easing problems from screen exposure, including eye strain or fatigue, blurred vision, headache, and dry, irritated, itchy, or red eyes. So now some suggestions from this article from Parade Magazine. First one, pretty simple, blink. On the average, we blink about 15 times per minute. But when we stare at our screens, our rate of blinking gets cut roughly in half. Blinking is beneficial to the eyes, bathing and moisturizing them, and supplying nutrients. Less blinking equals dry, irritated eyes. The next hint, look away. You've heard this one before. Dr. Singh recommends the 20-20-20 rule. Look away from your screen every 20 minutes. Focus on an object 20 feet away from you for at least 20 seconds. The 20-20-20 rule. The next suggestion is to lubricate. Eye drops can ease dryness. And then he goes on to say, wear your glasses. Swap your contact lenses for your glasses while you use the computer. Contacts can dry out and irritate your eyes, especially if you're not blinking enough. Another suggestion, avoid glare. Move your computer away from windows or light sources that are directly in front of or behind your monitor. A matte filter also may help avoid glare. This can cause you to squint and can result in headaches. Another idea, distance yourself. Sit about 25 inches or arm's length away from the screen. Position your screen's height so that you are looking slightly downward at it. And now the whole page finishes by a little boxed article here that says, can blue light cause age-related macular degeneration? Age-related macular degeneration, or AMD, occurs when a portion of the retina called the macula becomes damaged. The condition, which can evolve from a dry to a more serious wet form, prevents you from seeing fine details and affects your central vision while keeping your peripheral or your side vision intact. Blue light passes through the cornea and lens and ultimately reaches the retina, and some research suggests that this light may lead to or worsen AMD. But many experts say that the blue light you need to worry about comes from the sun, not from your electronic devices, which is why they advise everyone to wear UV-blocking sunglasses. In fact, experts at Harvard Medical School say that factors like aging, smoking, cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, or being overweight are far more significant than exposure to blue light in the development of AMD. And once again, this article came from the Parade magazine, that little insert they put into your Sunday paper. And the next article from Parade magazine was published in October of last year, and this too is a full-page article. It's part of the Stay Healthy column, like the last one was. The headline says, "What Your Eyes Are Trying to Tell You." A window into your soul, yes, but your eyes also reflect the state of your health. This also was written by Cheryl Kraft. She starts with a quote that says, "The eyes are the only organ in the body where we can see your blood vessels, retina, and optic nerve, which is a part of the central nervous system," says Alexandra Rakitskaya, who's an MD and a vitreoretinal specialist and assistant professor of ophthalmology at the Cleveland Clinic's Cole Eye Institute. And Dr. Rakishava continues and says, "That's why the eyes provide a lot of valuable information about your health. In addition to symptoms of the more traditional eye ailments, cataracts, glaucoma, age-related macular degeneration, here are some healthy warning signs on your eye doctor's radar. First of all, cognitive impairment. Healthy blood flow to the brain is important for its function, and diseases of the circulatory or vascular system can contribute to cognitive impairment. In a study published in the journal called Neurology, researchers found that since the brain and the eye's blood vessels share similar qualities, unhealthy retinal blood vessels could translate into the same for the brain's blood vessels and might be an early predictor of greater cognitive decline over time. The next possibility that they're thinking about, diabetes. It's called the silent killer because early symptoms which impair the body's ability to regulate blood sugar can go undiagnosed. In fact, one in four people doesn't even know they have it. Here's a quote, "I've diagnosed patients with diabetes simply by examining their eyes," says Dr. Rakitskaya. "Diabetes can cause fluctuations in vision, bleeding or swelling of the retina, and lead to the complication of diabetic retinopathy. Early diagnosis of diabetes may prevent this condition and help preserve sight." The next condition that doctors are looking at would be high cholesterol. A white, gray, or bluish ring around the front part of the eye, the cornea, which is usually clear, is common as you age and is not problematic, but when it forms in childhood or early adulthood, it can signal elevated cholesterol, a condition that causes the buildup of plaque in blood vessels and increases the risk of heart attack, stroke, and other health problems. Soft, flat growths around the eyelids also can be a sign of high cholesterol, which may raise your risk for glaucoma. And another condition, high blood pressure. Hypertension often has no obvious symptoms, and you can have it for years without knowing it. But an eye exam might detect a sign, and that would be bleeding blood vessels in the back of the eye, or blood vessels that are unusually twisted or curved. Here's a quote, "Patients might not realize these are hypertensive changes, which is why a dilated eye exam can be so valuable," says Dr. Rakitskaya. "Untreated, high blood pressure increases the risk of heart attack and stroke and could contribute to the development of glaucoma or macular degeneration." The next general health condition, what your eyes are trying to tell you, pertains to thyroid disease. Hyperthyroidism, or an overactive thyroid, can speed up your metabolism and cause an irregular or rapid heartbeat. Another sign may be bulging eyes, frequently caused by Graves' disease, an autoimmune disorder in which your thyroid produces more hormones than your body needs. Thyroid disease also may cause red, dry, or watery eyes. The next health condition they mention is stroke. Sudden numbness, confusion, and severe headache are some signs of stroke, which affects up to 800,000 Americans each year. But some symptoms strike without warning. Temporary vision changes or persistent vision loss can be a sign of an oncoming stroke or one that's already occurred, says Dr. Rachaskaya. Those changes, like the loss of central vision, are usually sudden and painless. And here's a quote. But the patient should be evaluated promptly by an ophthalmologist or even in the emergency room, since it could indicate an increased risk of a cerebral stroke, she says. Usually the vision loss is permanent, but with timely assessment, she says, we can prevent a life-threatening situation. Another health condition that they're looking at is vitamin A deficiency. This vitamin, found in many fruits, veggies, and animal products, produces pigments in the retina and is important for good eyesight, especially in low light. Dry eyes, which can cause redness, stinging, light sensitivity, and night blindness, can be a sign of insufficient vitamin A, the top cause of preventable childhood blindness in the world. The next and final health warning sign that the article talks about is Lyme disease. You might not remember being bitten by a tick and be surprised when you learn through an eye exam that you have this tick-borne disease. In its early stages, there may be an increase of floaters or conjunctivitis or pink eye, a condition that causes redness and a discharge of pus. While typically highly contagious, conjunctivitis caused by Lyme disease is not contagious. Though uncommon, Lyme disease in later stages can also affect the eye's optic nerve and result in vision loss. So once again, this article was titled, What Your Eyes Are Trying to Tell You. Your Eyes Reflect the State of Your Health. That was the last of the articles from Parade Magazine, and now we'll switch to the good old newspaper. In this case, it's from the Democrat and Chronicle, published in Rochester, New York, but this doctor is a nationwide columnist. It's from the Dr. Roach column, and the headline reads, Adult Son's Lazy Eye is Beginning to Drift Again. Dear Dr. Roach, I am a 65-year-old woman. As a child, I had what we called lazy eye. My condition was that my right eye was aligned noticeably outward. I believe this is referred to as exotropia. I had surgery to correct it at the age of 12, and surgery was successful. My right eye has remained in proper alignment since then. Well, my son, now age 32, had the same condition as a child and also had surgery around the age of 12. It was successful at the time, but in the past year or so, we are noticing that his eye is once again drifting to the outside. He has been hearing and reading about a new therapy using virtual reality screens and exercises to retrain the eye. When I look online, I find many ads and what they call informational websites by the companies that offer this therapy. I find very few medical websites that discuss this type of treatment. What do you know about it? Are there other effective non-surgical treatments for adults? This is signed with the initials SC. And this is once again a question to Dr. Keith Roach, who writes a column called To Your Health in newspapers all over the country. He answers by saying strabismus is the general term for lazy eye, where the gaze of the affected eye points sideways. Exotropia for pointing to the outside, esotropia for pointing inward. Symptoms can include double vision, headache, and eye strain. Symptoms are an indication for treatment. Although surgery is one common treatment, not everyone needs to be treated, and there are nine surgical alternatives. Passive vision therapy, such as putting a patch over the unaffected eye is a time-honored technique in children, though I could find little about it in adults. Active vision therapy, the eye retraining techniques you mentioned, has also been tried and shown to be effective in children up to age 17. Another study showed that orthoptic exercises are as effective in adults as they are in children at relieving symptoms. New onset of inability to move the eye to one side could indicate a serious problem with the nerve to that eye, so that should be promptly evaluated. And once again, this was the 2-Year Health column by Dr. Keith Roach. And I have one other article. This actually is an insert that came in my RG&E, my Rochester Gas and Electric bill a little while ago, with all kinds of good tips about being ready and prepared dealing with winter. And I'll read you some of those little sections within this bill insert. It's called Energy Lines, and it was published in December of 2020. The first one says, we're ready, and we want you to be ready too. We work year-round to improve and maintain our electricity delivery system so you have the reliable service you depend on. If harsh winter storms come blowing in, our team is ready to respond and keep you informed. Weather any storm with outage alerts. This information, by the way, is pertaining directly to the Rochester Gas and Electric in Rochester, New York, but I would assume that no matter where you live, you have a similar service provided by your power company, and I would suggest that you find out how to get these outage alerts to keep you safe. And here they say, receive an alert if the power goes out. You can choose how you want to receive your alert, by text, you can have it by email, or by telephone, or all three. I'm going to give you some phone numbers here to write down, so be ready. Easily report an outage if you have an iPhone or a cell phone. You can text the word OUT, O-U-T, to this number, 743-898. That is a 6-digit number. It's not a regular phone number, but it works if you text the word OUT, if you have an outage, to 743-898. You can also check the status of an outage anytime from anywhere by using the same number, but you would text the word status, S-T-A-T-U-S. Status, you would text it to the number 743-898, and you can find the status of an outage anytime. You can get a confirmation when your power is restored. Be ready, you can sign up for outage alerts at their website, rge.com. And here's a little tip about that number, 743-898. Save it in your contacts as something like, put it under TXTRGE, text RG&E, or something else like that that's easy for you to remember for quick access to report outage, or you can check on the status of any outage. And at the RG&E website, you'd have to set up an account. It's easy, a little button to push on their website, and then you would go to a part of the site that's called Manage Outage Alerts. And then you would go to a section called Set Up Contacts. That's how you would do it on our Rochester Gas and Electric website. The next article I'm going to share with you is titled Safety Tips, Winter Weather. Natural gas chimneys and vents should be kept clear of snow and ice to prevent the buildup of potentially deadly carbon monoxide. And yes, we're in Rochester, New York. We do have snow and ice. The next tip they give you is electric and natural gas meters and regulators should be kept clear of snow and ice by using a broom or by hand. Do not use a shovel. Never bury electric or natural gas meters, natural gas pipes, or natural gas regulators with snow. The next safety tip for winter, please clear a pathway to outside meters so your meter reader has clear and safe access. We'll be able to provide you with a bill based on your actual energy use if we can access your meter safely. And a little note from me here, two things. Actually, you can sign up to have your meters read by you, and this means you have to get access to an outdoor meter as well as a meter in the basement, or you can simply ignore it for a month or two until the weather gets better. The electric company will estimate your bill, but they'll make it right in the long run for you. So keep an eye on those meters, outdoors and indoors. And another tip they give you is, should a meter become encased in ice or begin to make any unusual noise, please call us. RG&E's number is 1-800-743-1701. That's if your meter outdoors is encased in ice, or if any meter makes an unusual noise, call them. 1-800-743-1701. And again, for more information, you can go to your safety section at the website rgne.com. The next article I have from the insert in the bills this month, natural gas piping. Homes built after 1990, or older structures that have had work done to the natural gas system, might have something called corrugated stainless steel tubing, CSST. This might be installed if your homes were built after 1990 or an older structure that has had work done recently. If the CSST, the corrugated stainless steel tubing, was improperly installed and lightning strikes the structure, the traveling lightning could cause a natural gas leak or possibly a fire. All homes and businesses should have a professional inspect the natural gas system to identify the CSST. And once again, those are corrugated stainless steel tubing. If CSST is identified, we recommend that a licensed electrician ensure that the CSST is bonded and properly grounded. It's important to inspect all types of natural gas pipes to make sure they are properly maintained. For more information, you can go to their safety section at their website, rge.com. Another article from this bill insert that came recently, they say, we are here to help. Are you or someone you know having trouble managing your energy bills? We have programs available to help qualified customers manage their energy costs. There are two that they suggest. The first one is the Home Energy Assistance Program. This is a federal grant program. It does not apply just to Rochester or New York. It's a federal program that helps income-eligible households pay for energy bills, repairs, and weatherization. Households may receive one regular HEAP benefit per season. Your county's Department of Social Services is currently accepting applications. Please visit the section called mybenefits.ny.gov to apply. And then from there, you would go to a section called Am I Eligible? Or you could go to a section called New Users, Apply for HEAP, H-E-A-P, the Home Energy Assistance Program, a federal grant program. Next, we have a program they suggest. It's called, from RG&E, it's called Our Energy Assistance Program, or the EAP. This helps eligible customers manage their energy bills through two levels of assistance. You could apply for monthly bill credit or limited benefit arrears forgiveness. For a complete list of assistance programs, please visit the website, www.rgne.com. You would click on Account, and then you would click on Help with the Bill. The final section of this bill insert might be a little bit late for this year, but keep it in mind for next year. They suggest stay warm and comfortable while managing your energy use. How much energy you use depends on a variety of factors, including how many people are in your home, your daily habits, the weather, and the time of year. Now that colder months are here, stay comfortable while understanding and managing your energy costs with our free tools and services. There are two that they mention. You can purchase energy-saving products directly from our online store. For the Rochester area people, their website is www.rgesmartsolutions.com. Purchase energy-saving products directly from their store. You can also avoid the seasonal ups and downs of your energy costs when you enroll in the budget billing service. Your energy costs are spread out evenly over 12 months, so you know how much your bill will be every month. You can enroll by calling their automated line at 1-800-295-7323. You would press option 2 for billing and payments. And to summarize today's program, together we have tidied up many of the little clippings that had gathered in my work area. You heard about three famous people and their vision challenges, and you heard about the 20-20-20 rule and other tips to avoid tech-tired eyes. You heard updates on lazy eye and timely tips for winter safety. To end the program today, I have a quote for you to think about. Clutter, in its highest form, is called collecting. This was said by Ada Louise Huxtable. She pioneered modern architectural criticism in the pages of the New York Times. She celebrated buildings that respected human dignity and civic history, and she memorably scalded those that did not. She won the very first ever Pulitzer Prize for criticism. Her name again, Ada Louise Huxtable. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Take Care of Texas Kids Art Contest runs from January 4th through March 5th, 2021. K-5 students in Texas are invited to enter their artwork. Six students and one lucky teacher will win a tablet or laptop. To sign up or for more details, visit takecareoftexas.org/kids/k-5-art-contest.
As we live through one of the country's most severe economic downturns, we strive to bring you information about money, investing, consumer news, and the energy industry. Mondays at 6 a.m., it's the Kiplinger's newsletter and Money Matters. Tuesdays at 6 a.m., The Economist. Wednesdays at 6 a.m., a weekly roundup of the Lone Star State with News of Texas. Thursdays at 6 a.m., Consumer Reports. And Fridays at 6 a.m., Permian Basin Oil and Business News from the Midland Report. Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Weekday mornings at 6 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 56 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael with a programming reminder. The coronavirus update will now air this afternoon following the local newspapers at 4:30 p.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service. GARS, hello. I'm Sonal Pathak, bringing you Shape and Women's Health magazines. I'll be reading from the March 2021 issue of Women's Health magazine. The first article is Split Decision by Courtney Rubin. Getting a hysterectomy can change your life, and not always for the better. Newer salves to treat bleeding and pain exist, yet many women and doctors are still going for the nuclear option, unnecessarily. Women's Health investigates. Renee Meyer always had period pain so bad she couldn't function without ibuprofen. But in 2016, at 37 years old, she started going to the bathroom every hour and having problems with bladder leakage. Her doctor's initial suggestion was Kegel exercises. But when Meyer noticed her pelvic area was starting to appear pregnant when she wasn't, she returned to the doctor. An ultrasound uncovered the true problem. Fibroids, masses in the uterus that are benign over 99% of the time. And the solution? Removing her uterus so the fibroids could no longer grow. Meyer, now 42, didn't plan to have children, so she was on board with getting a hysterectomy. But the surgeon also suggested removing the cervix, the opening to the uterus, so she would no longer need pap smears. Meyer asked how that might affect her sex life. She couldn't find much online about which reproductive organs were involved in an orgasm. But the doctor she consulted told her there would be no difference, she recalls. Except there was. A lot of what women feel during orgasm is the contractions of the uterus and the cervix. While she doesn't regret going the route she did, Meyer says I'm pissed off there wasn't more information. I miss cervical orgasms. She's not the only one who has dealt with a major information gap around such a life-altering procedure. Hysterectomies have been around since before the Middle Ages, but only in the past couple of decades have researchers started to prove what for years was whispered among those who had one. Removing the organ sometimes causes problems, at least as much as it solves them. And although there are now less drastic options, many women aren't provided with them, or they're encouraged to go full bore and remove the uterus because that solution is the most obvious and easiest. We're not talking about instances of cancer or possible cancer, where removing the uterus really may be the only option. About 90% of hysterectomies are done for reasons unrelated to cancer. Hysterectomies are the second most common surgery among women of reproductive age in the U.S., and one of the most controversial. The procedure popped up in celebrity news when Girls star Lena Dunham made headlines for choosing to have one at age 31. And tales of doctors forcing patients into the procedure without any medical reason, such as the Virginia OBGYN convicted late last year after he performed hysterectomies at his discretion for insurance fees. But the question of who receives a hysterectomy and why was a contentious topic in the medical community long before all of this. A hysterectomy is technically only the removal of the uterus, also known as the womb, where a fetus develops and grows and which plays a critical role in your menstrual cycle and fertility. But people tend to use the term hysterectomy as shorthand to cover a lot of other procedures that may happen at the same time, like removal of ovaries and fallopian tubes, and as a catch-all word for various techniques. The procedure is most commonly performed to fix pain and bleeding from a variety of reproductive health issues, ranging from fibroids, which may affect as many as two-thirds of women by age 50, to endometriosis and adenomyosis, the conditions in which the endometrial tissue grows in places it shouldn't. Here's where things get sticky. The number of alternate treatments for these types of health issues is growing, yet the number of women getting hysterectomies seems to have remained fairly stable, at roughly 500,000 a year. Seems to, because like many things in women's health, the truth is murky. Some studies and CDC figures suggest the rate of hysterectomies has declined, but a bunch of these studies included only women receiving treatment for fibroids, which excludes an awful lot who received hysterectomies for other reasons, notes a brief from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. Other figures include only abdominal and vaginal types, excluding outpatient hysterectomies done robotically or via laparoscopy, which are on the rise because they're less invasive, require a much smaller incision, and typically have a shorter, easier recovery. Abdominal hysterectomies are the traditional open surgery kind your grandmother might have had. Laparoscopic and robotic have been around since 1988 and 1999, respectively. No matter the numbers, there are still a lot of reasons to believe hysterectomies are done more often than they should be. Are we doing too many hysterectomies? I'd say the consensus among providers who perform them would be that there are probably too many performed right now, says Christopher Ternay, MD, Division Chief of Urogynecology and Reconstructive Pelvic Surgery at UCLA. There are now less invasive hysterectomy techniques, so that approach has taken over, he says. But the trend hasn't moved away from hysterectomy entirely. The facts. As many as 1 in 5 women who underwent the surgery for a benign condition may not have needed the procedure, found a study published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. For women under 40, that figure may be as many as 2 in 5. And what's more, black women are getting them more than any other group. The clear divide. Black women are 2.4 times more likely to have a hysterectomy than white women, according to a study in the Journal of Women's Health. Part of the reason for that is because they're also three times more likely to develop fibroids. The Real Housewives of Atlanta's Cynthia Bailey and Portia Williams opened up on the show about their fibroids. And the condition is so sufficiently understudied that then-Senator, now VP, Kamala Harris, introduced a bill proposing $30 million a year for 5 years to expand fibroid research. The hard truth is that many black women grow up expecting to grit their teeth through the pain until they've had kids and can get a hysterectomy. Carol Cook, 57 years old, of Phoenix, said, "My mother had a hysterectomy in her 40s because of the fibroids, and she didn't look back." Because of her own fibroids, Cook herself endured pain she describes as fear-inducing. "I wanted to curl up in a ball and have someone knock me out until it was over." After her son was born, she had a hysterectomy at 35 and is happy with the results. But black women are less likely to be offered a minimally invasive hysterectomy, which comes with shorter recovery times and fewer complications, even when you account for risk factors like weight and general health, says Amy Alexander, MD, a gynecologist-oncologist in Asheville, North Carolina. Dr. Alexander began studying racial disparities in care when she was working in Chicago and noticed the patients at Northwestern University's hospital, which has a larger percentage of white patients than Cook County Hospital, a Chicago public hospital, seemed more likely to receive minimally invasive hysterectomies. "Doctors work hard, nurses work hard, everybody tries their best. But people end up with different care because there are different systems," she says. Doing a minimally invasive hysterectomy also depends on the training of the doctor and the equipment available at the medical center. Dr. Alexander herself says she couldn't do a complicated one if the hospital didn't have a robot, something many county and small hospitals can't afford. "Nor might a county hospital have a bed that tilts the patient back so the doctor can see into the pelvis, an essential for a long, minimally invasive surgery. Because of this, many women in underserved hospitals just end up getting the old school procedure. An imperfect solution. Ultimately, hysterectomies are not always the magical fix women and doctors expect them to be. But if the problematic organ isn't there anymore, all your issues are solved, you'd think. Not so much. One example, women who opt for a hysterectomy to address endometriosis have a 15% probability of persistent pain even after the surgery, with a 3 to 5% risk of worsening pain or new symptom development, according to a review of studies in Facts, Views, and Vision, Issues in Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Health. Meanwhile, removing the uterus can cause side effects, including bladder dysfunction and pelvic pain from scarring. Because your organs shift after one is removed, some women report various types of chronic pain, like hip or back, which then radiates up to neck pain and can cause migraines, says Heather Hirsch, MD, an internist specializing in women's health at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Women who have hysterectomies also face a nearly twofold increased risk of going into early menopause, a study in obstetrics and gynecology found. And women who undergo the surgery younger than 35 also have a greater chance of suffering from depression, per a Mayo Clinic study. So why, then, are so many women still getting hysterectomies if there are not a significant number of downsides? It's complicated. The range of treatments for pain and bleeding now includes everything from progesterone IUDs, which help thin the endometrium and in turn treat abnormal bleeding and pain, to uterine artery embolizations, where the artery that leads to the uterus is cauterized, a procedure that requires a referral to an interventional radiologist. For fibroids specifically, there's the option of a myomectomy, where the growths are snipped out but the uterus is spared, but they can grow back. That's the reality with many alternate options. They simply might not be a permanent solve for the underlying health issue. IUDs, for example, often don't work for women with larger uteruses, says Daniel Morgan, MD, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Michigan Medical School and Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital. And because fibroids in particular change the shape of the uterus, it may be difficult to get an IUD deployed safely. Another technique called an endometrial ablation which destroys the uterus lining, comes with the risk of developing pain from regrowth and blood trapped under scar tissue. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists offered a caution about the procedure that reads, in part, that it should only be considered if other treatments have been ineffective or contraindicated. So you can imagine why the conversations about the risks and benefits of each option can be difficult and lengthy, says Dr. Hirsch. That's another barrier and a big reason why it's sometimes easier for doctors to say, let's just take the uterus out. Compounding the issues is that doctors, like all of us, have many biases, says women's health advocate and activist Nora Coffey, who founded the Hysterectomy Educational Resource and Services Foundation, HERS. Women are routinely told, what do you need your uterus for if they've already had children, she says. Early education. So let's clarify here. Why you do need a uterus, regardless of kid status. Besides the risk for early menopause and depression, women who've had hysterectomies are at increased odds for high blood pressure, obesity, and heart disease, a Mayo Clinic study found. Researchers don't yet understand what the role of the uterus is in all of this. Long-term issues are especially pronounced the younger you have the hysterectomy. Women younger than 35 who had the procedure had a 4.6-fold higher risk for congestive heart failure, compared with women above that age who had just a 0.6% higher risk. When Dr. Hirsch sees new patients, she'll ask those who underwent the procedure why they had a hysterectomy. She is curious about their understanding of it, and many don't know because, for some women, speaking out and asking questions about their bodies is still taboo. Dr. Hirsch says, a lot of women who tell me that they aren't sure why they got the procedure follow up with, I wish I never did, or I wish someone had told me there are alternatives. It's not as surprising as you might think for an expert not to know much about an alternative treatment option, considering the sheer volume of information OBGYNs are expected to be on top of. One survey of OBGYNs suggested that surgical training was not adequate, in part because of how overloaded residents are. They not only need to be competent in obstetrics, primary care, and office gynecology, but they must master a multitude of surgical techniques and be competent with evolving technology, it noted. Hysterectomy has the advantage in that every gynecologist knows how to do one, but not every gynecologist is trained in some of the other procedures, says Elizabeth Stewart, MD, a Mayo Clinic gynecologist who specializes in fibroid research. I think one of the saddest things for women is that some are not presented with any alternatives to hysterectomy when good ones exist. All the more reason to do your own research before you get on the exam table. Speaking up. True story. Advocating for yourself and digging into the options can make a big difference. Kristen Bennett, 37 years old, of Los Angeles, was diagnosed with fibroids when she was 25. She suffered through the pain for more than a decade until, in the past 2 years, she began bleeding so badly that she worried she'd bleed out. She was so exhausted some days she couldn't make breakfast, and she also developed heart palpitations and acid reflux. Bennett started going to doctors. One suggested a radiofrequency ablation, which would destroy the fibroids, but is not recommended for women who want to preserve their fertility, which Bennett did. Another told her he could try to do a myomectomy, but that she should go in prepared to come out with a hysterectomy because he didn't feel confident her uterus was salvageable. The others told her the only option was a hysterectomy, and if she wanted kids, she'd have to hang tough until she was done with that. In the end, Bennett went to 6 doctors until she found one who was confident he could do a myomectomy, which she had in June. I did a lot of research. I knew there were options, she says. Wary after her experience with the other physicians, Bennett began instructing the 6th doctor about which organs she wanted to keep, her ovaries and cervix, if he had to do a hysterectomy in the end. He said, I hear what you're saying, but this is not a complicated case. You're going to be fine. He took out 24 fibroids. 4 were the size of oranges. Within weeks, she felt relief. I'm not terrified that I'm going to pass out from my period, she says. Action plan. If you've been suffering from pain and bleeding, the hysterectomy conversation may be coming, but you can be prepared for it. When you make the appointment, ask first for a consultation in the doctor's office, so you're not undressed in a gown and stirrups in a vulnerable position. You can be blunt. Introduce yourself and say, "I'm here for an evaluation, and I'm not going to have a hysterectomy," Coffey says. That changes the dynamic immediately. It may turn out that you do need a hysterectomy, but at least you'll know that you and your provider have considered all the options. And keep in mind that some women do say it's life-changing, but in a good way. Leslie Mullen, 41 years old, of Houston, had a hysterectomy at age 36 and says, "I was overjoyed." Among other things, Mullen had for years dealt with pain during sex, which disappeared with her hysterectomy. Dr. Alexander suggests asking what the doctor recommends to patients before resorting to a hysterectomy, as you would with any procedure. If they go ahead and suggest a hysterectomy, ask what the alternatives are and what the likelihood is that those alternatives would be successful for you. If you're having difficulty getting answers, seek a second or third opinion. It's your body, after all. There's such a long history of hysterectomy being frequently used that the conversation can get to that very quickly, says Dr. Morgan. But we all need to slow down and say, "Hey, wait, what about these other options? Let's make sure we're doing the right thing for you," as it should be. That was Split Decision by Courtney Rubin. The next article is Clear the Air by Nicole Blades. With chronic respiratory conditions on the rise in women, it's time to give your lungs a little love and make it a point to breathe easy for the long haul. You've got this. Just breathe. You've likely heard that advice a lot recently, and while focusing on your inhalation is useful when you need to calm down, taking a proper breath is easier said than done, especially in a world that can be hard on lungs. COVID-19 brought the air-filled organs to the forefront of our minds, as some coronavirus patients have faced long-term respiratory damage. But lung health has been a growing concern for doctors for reasons besides that. Chronic respiratory disorders are on the rise in women. Here's one case study. Over the past 42 years, the lung cancer rate in women has jumped 84%, per the American Lung Association. Smoking is still the primary cause, but the number of never-smokers developing the disease is increasing. Researchers suspect that biologically, women may be more susceptible to this cancer, and that a history of certain infections like HPV and pollution could be contributing. Air pollution causes an estimated 7 million deaths every year, says Rohan Arora, a climate activist and ALA advisor, and nearly half of all Americans are breathing unhealthy air. The reassuring part: a few tweaks to your habits can dramatically improve your lung breath and protect you from factors you can't control. Here's how to breathe better. 1. All-around air. Where you take the majority of your breaths matters. Your lungs are at the very mercy of your environment, says Jamie Garfield, MD, an associate professor of thoracic medicine and surgery at the Lewis Katz School of Medicine at Temple University. They're constantly exposed to whatever pollution is around you. When you live in or visit places with large amounts of environmental pollutants, like carbon monoxide, black carbon, smog, and tiny particles like soot, industrial chemicals, and dust, your lungs have to work overtime, which could lead to chronic diseases like asthma, bronchitis, emphysema, and lung cancer, among others, she says. One of the best things you can do to preserve lung health is to minimize your interaction with pollution as much as possible, says Gretchen Winter, MD, a pulmonary and critical care physician at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. That means avoiding smoke, like from cigarettes and forest fires, mold, especially after severe weather, gases, like from cleaning products, emissions, and smog, and radon. If you're an outdoor workout girl in an urban area, exercise in spaces where there's less vehicle traffic and fewer factories, says Dr. Winter. Also, check the air quality index in your area on sites like airnow.gov or apps such as Plume Labs and Breathe Air Quality Index, and work out indoors on the days with bad air quality. Those face masks you've been wearing during the pandemic, they actually help to decrease unwanted particles you breathe in, says Dr. Garfield. 2. Dust Dilemma. be aware of air quality inside, too. Dust mites, pet dander, and mold can lurk in your home and trigger allergies and asthma, or worsen existing respiratory symptoms, says Barimal Barucha, MD, head of the pulmonary and critical care at Mercy Medical Group. You can keep the buildup of these particles to a minimum by washing your bedsheets in hot water at least once a week and vacuuming or damp mopping frequently. Wearing a mask while you clean also provides protection from chemicals and dust. Other smart moves. Toss any moldy things that can't be cleaned. Reconsider long drapes and curtains to help reduce the surfaces where dust mites like to gather. And break the news to the fur babies that they're banned from your bed. 3. Sweat principle. Your lungs play an essential role in keeping you strong, says Dr. Barucha. But you don't think much about them until you experience problems. Exercising is a key way to make sure they stay in shape. National guidelines push for 150 to 300 minutes weekly of moderate cardio or 75 to 150 minutes of high-intensity work. That could look like a 30-minute fast-paced run Monday and Tuesday, a 60-minute power walk Wednesday, another fast half-hour run Thursday, and an hour of tennis on Friday, with two rest days and two strength training workouts folded into each week. As you become more physically fit, your body is more effective at getting oxygen into your blood and getting it to the parts of your body that need it, says Dr. Winter. Regular exercise also helps clear mucus from the lungs. 4. Posture power. Thanks in large part to more remote work, people are sitting more and for longer stretches. When parking it, you should take shallow breaths instead of deeper ones. Poor posture has us scrunched, with our pec muscles and abs tight, says physical therapist Meredith Saxon-Kowalski, owner of Center Sports Physical Therapy. Your lungs can't expand properly. Take breaks from sitting at least once an hour to stretch, says Saxon-Kowalski. Pectoral and cat stretches open your chest so you can take deeper breaths. When working out, focus on exercises like Superman's, which fire up your posterior chain, the back muscles that keep you from rounding forward, says Saxon-Kowalski. This combination of flexibility work and resistance training will improve your posture and, in turn, your breathing. And you'll need to work on strengthening the abs to sit straight, she said. Sighs of relief. You would think you know how to breathe, since you do it all day long. But we only use 50 to 60% of lung capacity on a normal inhalation, says Mangala Narasimhan, DO, medical director of the Acute Lung Injury Program at Northwell Health. When you take a proper breath, you open lower areas of the lungs and bump up that percentage. To get closer to max capacity, practice belly breathing. Here's how. 1. Sit or lie flat in a comfortable position. 2. Put one hand on your lower belly and the other on your chest. 3. Inhale deeply through your nose, expanding your belly so it pushes out and lifts your hand. 4. Breathe out through your mouth or pursed lips, as if blowing through a straw, letting your chest fall and drawing your ab muscles into your spine. 5. Do 3 to 10 reps 3 or 4 times a day. So, you used to smoke. Maybe it was a part of a too-cool phase in college, or you spent time around a smoker in the past. No judgment here, but you should listen to your body even more now. Lung damage caused by smoking does not always show up in symptoms or on medical tests until it's more severe, says Dr. Winter. But if you're experiencing shortness of breath or chronic cough, let your doctor know. They may recommend pulmonary function tests, which help detect a lung decline from smoking or other causes. Pulmonologists and health professionals will always tell you to avoid putting any tar, soot, or toxins that come from smoking or vaping into your sacs. If you use cannabis to manage anxiety or pain, consider edibles or tinctures, oils, or gummies. They won't impact your lungs at all. And oh, if you are a smoker, once you stop, your rate of lung decline significantly improves, says Dr. Winter. That was Clear the Air by Nicole Blades. That concludes today's readings from Shape and Women's Health magazines. This has been Sonal Pathak for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa.